Today on the Low Light Music Podcast, I'm thrilled to be chatting to Suna Ruthia. Suna is an award-winning lighting and production designer. You know, I worked on like some small shows like Coldplay and Muse and Paramore and The Lumineers and Motley Crue. And the list goes on and on. Like, she's a legend. Suna also runs a bunch of businesses and is part of a not-for-profit in the US called The Even Project, which is really fascinating, which I'm really excited to talk to her about. So here we go. Suna Ruthia. Is it Ruthia? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's right.
That's a good start.
French Canadian. My mom was born in just south of Montreal in Quebec. So
it's, cool. I love Montreal.
Yeah.
I've been before. It was freezing cold.
Yeah, it's really, really cold. And my dad's whole family is from Quebec too. So basically I'm first generation on my mom's side, second generation on my dad's side.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Suna Ruthia, the reason why I asked the pronunciation of your name is because like we've never met. Before.
Yeah.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm just a random guy on Instagram that reached out because I'm a fan of the shows you worked on. Just to talk to you about your career, really, about the shows you work on, the job roles and the businesses that you do, and the Even Network, which I think is an incredible thing. Just as somebody that is a music lover, I work in music, I love music, I've done it my entire life. And I, with my partner Matt, we're setting up this thing called Learn Thy Music, which I hope we'll talk a little bit about, is how could we provide learning resources for the next generation of professionals coming to the live music sector, the thing that we're so passionate about. So yeah. Hello, person just met this on the internet.
Hello.
Okay, hey. So lighting designer and production designer, two huge roles, and you do them both simultaneously?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I started in the business like 23 years ago, and when I started, the role of lighting designer was actually, it was kind of like more all encompassing. Like I started in clubs. So like as a lighting designer in a club setting, you're kind of in charge of the entire visual look of the whole stage. So just by default, production design just kind of came naturally because like, you know, the first band I worked with, Chevelle out of Chicago, they're like this three-piece rock band. You know, one of their album covers was all white. So it's like, we should cover your amps in white fabric and then light them up. And then we should, so like by then you're like talking set design kind of, yeah. Right? So, just by like default, I just ended up becoming a production designer because I was kind of in charge of the visual elements of all the stage via lighting. And then, I was always like the lighting operator/designer on tour. So
that's so cool. Yeah. Did you study lighting design anywhere?
I did. I went to Emerson College in Boston. And before that, I went to a smaller school in Vermont called Johnson State, where actually, like, I learned so much there because I was behind the board all the time. Like, I was constantly working with lighting because it was a smaller school and they didn't have a theater degree per se. They just had a theater with a tech department. So there wasn't like, you know, 50, 60 students trying to get onto a production. It was more just like I was in the theater every single day working with the gear. So yeah. I probably learned more there than I did from Emerson just because of the sheer amount of time I was able to spend in there. And that's where I got my first gig professionally as well. I had a band come through that needed additional lighting and audio support. And I just was kind of a nerd about it all, and I asked to tag along in the next gigs with them, and every weekend I would travel to the show, and then I was hired by them. So it was like, yeah.
What year was that?
Yeah. Okay, so I graduated high school in 97 and in 98 started at Johnson State, graduated there with like a really small degree, associates in 99, and then moved to Emerson and finished there in 2001. Wow.
I was going to say 21. That's a lesson.
I'm like, yeah, it took me 21 years to graduate college. No,
you learned a lot though.
2001, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So from 2001 to 2023 and Coldplay stadiums around the world, like how does that, what's the progression there? Tell me a bit about the journey.
Yeah. So I was working locally in the Boston area for, I think 5 years, like through college and then a couple of years afterwards. And I was freelancing as a lighting tech/lighting operator, doing a lot of corporates and a lot of concerts where they didn't have lighting on tour. And one of those companies did this tour with the Irish Tenors. and they needed a touring tech. So they asked me if I wanted to do it. It was my first tour ever. And I said, yes, absolutely. And I got the bug. And then ended up coming home and was working for another company. The one that I got my first professional gig with, called New England Audio Tech, Rainbow Concert Productions. And they had this like offshoot of Ozfest show come through town. And they provided additional audio and lighting support for it. So I went up as like the trust monkey, slash patch person. Right. So I was up there, like, you know, basically getting all the park hands and everything together. Focusing, and I knew all the LDs out there because I was really good at keeping in touch with people and making sure that, you know, making sure that I always networked and stayed friendly with different LDs, production managers, tour managers. And so one of the bands out there was Chevelle, and they had one requirement. They wanted all the lighting to just turn off completely in between each one of their songs. They didn't want anything, no blue wash, nothing. They didn't want anything. It would
be black. Total blackout.
Complete total blackout. I was like, okay, that's easy enough. So in between each song, I would just Grandmaster. And after the set, the tour manager was like, hey, we're going on tour in the fall. Would you be interested in going? I was like, yeah, of course. And because all the other LDs out there knew me, because I had talked to them over, you know, networked with them, they were like, she's going to be great. You need to hire her. And they did. And that was it. And from there, it was just network, do whatever I can. Like if I'm done before the audio guy at front of house, help flip the console, help coil the mic cables, like help everybody out. If I'm done picking up my floor lights and I can't take down my truss because somebody in backline is having a hard time with something, help, like just go. It's
awesome.
A team sport. And so I would just always be the person that was going a little bit above and beyond to get off the stage and out in the trucks. And frankly,
people don't
back
do
to
that.
Line. So,
That's so cool. People don't necessarily help out on either departments, do they? Not always.
I mean, I feel like I always saw people helping out, but I think these days, you know, the bottom line of having, you know, budgets and everything, you need to be able to streamline your crew and make sure that you have the exact amount of people in order to do the job at the exact amount of time and like the exact amount of equipment. So like, I feel like maybe I was just fortunate enough to be on crews where there was enough people to like be able to sort of spread the love a little bit, maybe. I don't know, or maybe it was just an anomaly. I don't know. I feel I like that. I always saw people kind of helping out in other departments. But yeah, I
did
mean,
you,
this is towards 16 years, so.
16 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much there as well. So I've worked in music like since I was 20, so 1920. So I must be, like, but touring internationally, maybe like 15 years.
Yeah.
From clubs all the way up. So, you know, I've learned to help load the truck or the trailer because there aren't enough people. I've learned those.
I used to have to flip cabinets, audio cabinets up. Like I'd be like one of the people on the side, like helping to flip. I was like, oh man, I was so strong back then. Now I'm just like sitting on my computer, just, you know, trying not to gain weight every day. Anyway.
No, one of my favorite memory, but it's really early on with Ellie I was working with. We were doing a US tour in San Diego, the Casbar. You remember the Casbar? Mm-hmm. This awesome little rock club. And we were one bus with a trailer and we didn't have enough crew, and the crew were absolutely amazing. So we were all loading the trailer as well. And my memory of this particular show is that the toilets flooded during the gig and the club was packed and it started to smell really weird. Ugh. We don't need to go into that story, but when we got to the end of the night, it's time to load out and our crew with everything is covered in waste, human waste. So it was like, right, everybody, gloves on, let's do this. We're all a team. There's no way two people are going to do this on their own. We've got to get involved, help each other out, get each other's backs, and then go and wash.
Closing down gear, yeah. Ooh.
Wash those flight cases. That's a different kind of story. I don't know why I told that one, but.
I'm sorry. I've never had to knock on wood and everything.
Well, and I've never been back to the Casbar since. So
yeah.
Maybe it's for the best. So Do you, over the course of those 16 years, you said that you worked in the industry, do you find that you sort of start gravitating towards like-minded people, like production people, that you started working on more gigs together?
Yep. So I met my former business partner on a show when I was working with Chevelle, and he was with Linkin Park. And he was about to go out as production manager on another tour, and they needed an LD to come out and operate because the designer wasn't available to go operate the tour. So he asked me to go out as the LD, and we just hit it off. And then the next tour he did, the same thing. He asked me to come out as LD, but there was a design component, like we needed to design a lighting rig for it. So suddenly I was designing a lighting rig for the tour. And then it just kind of spiraled from there. And we just realized, well, this is like, he had the technical know-how and I was designing with him, and we started just designing shows together. So that's what, like, Motley Crue and Kiss and the Lumineers and, oh gosh, so many, Lady Antebellum and Rascal Flatts and Pentatonix, like a lot of these tours were designed with him. We had a company called S-Ray Productions.
Right.
And in 2019, you know, he wanted to focus more on production management. I wanted to focus more on like on lighting design and not as much production design for a second. And did that. And we still worked together a little bit, and we still are very, 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 very dear friends. He's like an older brother to me. So, but yeah, I just sort of branched out and working as a, well, like the first gig I got on my own was Coldplay. So that worked out.
Sure. Just a small one.
As lighting designer. And then once again, same thing, just started falling back into production design again. yeah. And here we are. I now have a new company called The Playground.
I was going to ask you about The Playground. So do you have a team? Do you have a bunch of freelancers? And
it's very different. It is not right. Like a normal conventional design studio. And it's really hard for people to wrap their heads around. So imagine each project is treated as its own little separate entity, as its own little co-op.
Mm.
So what happens is, you know, we sort of taste make the team, or like there can be like, I don't even have to be involved in a project for The Playground, honestly. Like somebody can come in and just use the resources and run it through The Playground. We can be ghostwriters. We can just help produce.
Oh, that's cool.
That. Yeah. So essentially like each project is its own little thing. So like it kind of depends on what the needs are. So if somebody needs just lighting design, and I'm not available, we have a collective of individuals that, you know, we have, like we work with, we know, have the same values as we do. Mm. And so we say, yeah, this could be great. If you want to work with so-and-so, also, you know, we creative directed a rodeo in March, which was completely out of the realm of wild. Anything I've ever done. And that has nothing, like, that's not my standard production design work. One of our producers just helped produce a rock tour. We had nothing to do with the design. It was just literally helping them take their vision and make it into reality. And we are ghostwriters on that. So I can't even tell you the name of the tour because we're literally white label.
NDA'd.
Yeah. And also just white label. Like we don't want to be known, because our job and that was to help lift the design team up to make sure that they were successful, not to actually take any credit for being part of the design, but help lift it. So yeah, it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around, but if you just imagine
a cooperative.
Yeah, it is. It's like a co-op. Yeah. So each project is like its own little mini co-op. So like the shareholders involved in the product in each project, they share in the profit, but also the expenses. So there's like, you know, obviously there's legal and agency and marketing and insure, all these things that go into the expenses of creating something.
Yeah.
Now, like these, the collective is sharing in both the cost to make something, but also in the profits of making something.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a, when I first branched out on my own as a designer, I realized, oh my gosh, I can't do this alone without an assistant. But oh, how am I supposed to pay a yearly salary for someone to work for me full time?
Yeah.
Like, that's insane. And I just couldn't understand how individuals did that. Like, independent designers, like, how are they able to afford
It's like an
that?
Agency, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah, it's insane. But it's such a necessity these days because our world as production designers is so technical and it's moving so fast. And there's so many projects like beating you into the head all the time. So this was sort of the response of like, well, why can't I just collaborate with other people to make these projects happen? But also we're sharing in having somebody assist us, like instead of, you know, one person paying a yearly salary, like that person can very easily handle multiple projects. Like we should be sharing in the expense of that. So, yeah, that started in January. And
is it going well?
I think we're about to hire a second producer because
okay, so it's going well.
Our one producer is getting a little overloaded.
Wow, it's really inspiring. It's really inspiring. I'm a small business owner, and I'm in the field of like musical direction and that world over here in the UK. And always find it really inspiring to meet other creatives that are finding new ways to run their business, to scale their business, especially with labor and time.
Yeah. It's really like, my selfish way of making cool shit with my homies.
I love that. No, I love that. It's like the untraditional model of forming an agency and hiring young talent and just rent them out at a charge, right? I really like that.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah.
No, I might steal a little bit of that.
Going okay.
Good.
I know. Well, the best part about it is like we don't just do, you know, production design. We just now run the gambit, right? So like we have a choreographer we work with, we have stylists. So now we can, instead of us just taking on just like the lighting, video, special effects, like scenic design and show direction, we can now take on the whole thing. And it really makes these projects way more cohesive. So like if there's a pop artist that really wants somebody that's like taking the overall complete vision of the entire show, all of the entities that you need to make that happen are now under one roof.
And you're talking my language now because I've got like a million questions I could ask you, but I don't have time.
If you're enjoying this podcast, make sure to join The Industry, our email newsletter, where each week we send you something to read, watch and listen to, as well as the latest live music industry news. You can find it at learnlivemusic.com.
I guess as a musical director and helping an artist take apart their recorded work and finding the right tools and the right way of reimagining that on the stage, especially on like an arena stage, is that I'm like trying to, my goal is one day I'll work on this magical tour that may or may not ever exist that has this combination of the right creative and musical people that from creative direction and lighting direction, this symbiotic show. And I've seen them out there, you know, the shows that I love that I've seen, like the Bjork Biophilia is one that comes to mind straight away, of where clearly music and visual departments were so in sync on the vision from the artist, the delivery of that, and then the production management of that, how it all comes together. I'm always like really curious to talk to creative people like you, the lighting and production, on like the relationship between creative, like the ideation stage, as well as the music, because sometimes those departments can be really separated until you're thrown together into production rehearsals or when you're delivering time code from your MD team. How do you find that? It sounds like the right perfect thing to include in a cooperative, like as a creative thing.
Yes, 100%. We always want to be involved, not involved, but we always want to know as much as we can about the music and the set list as early as possible in the process. Like, because in the end, it's all about that, right? People fall in love with an artist because they hear the music on the radio or streaming, whatever. And so it's very important to remember that it always just comes back to the music, like it always does. I try to drill music into my skull when I have a new artist I'm working with.
Yeah, same.
I just listen to it over and over again. My husband gets really annoyed, especially when it's a pop act and not like a metal act. He gets really annoyed.
Always a metalhead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I just think it's really important. And it's funny because I know artists like really need to be able to think about their set lists ahead of time and like really get it into their brains before they distribute it out to the people that are actually gonna, you know, are gonna operate it or play it during the show, whatever. But I find that funny because I feel, and I don't know if it's because they're not thinking about the amount of logistics that goes into everything ahead of time, or if it's because, you know, they're so inundated with all these other things going on that they don't have time to focus on their set list. But that, like, literally the set list and like the music and what is going to be played is like the most important thing to get as soon as possible. And it's always the thing that ends up getting pushed to like the last possible minute.
So how do you deal with that?
I mean, we just beg and beg and beg and beg and beg as much as possible. And we'll get like a list of songs, and then eventually like we'll get the stems and the tracks with time code. And then we can execute what we need to do. But it's just a lot of begging and a lot of annoying the artists or management or the creative director or the musical director. And it's like, unfortunately, hands are just tied because like how, you know what I mean? It's, it relies on the artist's vision to be able to say, I'm going to play these songs during the show. And that's something that, they just don't, I don't think that anybody understands how important it is to get that as soon as possible.
Yeah, I found that maybe there's that sense of the artist sort of committing to this is the set of songs and these are the arrangements. Because they're always, I've sent some of those emails to people like you, Suna, going, I'm so sorry, here's revision 3 with updated time code. And it's like
here's
1 in the morning.
BPM. It's all in and off by a beat.
Yeah, the worst is BPM. There's a new tempo ramp, so you have to redo everything. So on behalf of musical directors, I'm sorry.
I mean, we always just get through it. In fact, one of my artists right now is, they just changed all their BPMs in just about every song, and they only have one more day of rehearsal tomorrow.
Wow. So your content's out.
They just got a recording of stems, and it got corrupted somehow, so they're like really in, they're trying really hard to get it done. But
is that a show with video as well, with content?
Yeah. And I think it's just like a lack of understanding of what, and it's no one's fault, right? Like the thing is, like, we're supposed to be behind the scenes and we're supposed to be the thing that makes the magic happen, right? No one's supposed to understand how it works, because that's the beauty of it. Like the person on stage is supposed to be, or the band on stage is supposed to be the ones shining brightly, not the production. And so I think it's just a kind of a challenge in our industry that like there's no lens on how all this stuff works. So like an artist who's just, you know, blowing up suddenly doesn't understand, oh, if I change that BPM, then all of the lighting cueing that I just approved now needs to be re-recorded. Also, I think there's now plugins that the MA has that can fix that. But
It's still a job, isn't it?
Don't do that anymore. Or like the content that just got rendered out that literally takes 24 hours just to render. Like, just like, let's do the edits and then turn the render on, and then it's going to take an entire 24 hours just for this thing to render down to be able to spit it out into a server. Then it needs to upload for an hour into the server and then reprogrammed in the, like, nobody understands that stuff. They're not supposed to. But if there was just a tiny bit of understanding, because like then when it goes wrong, because there's no time to get it done, or when you have a smart operator out there that just tells it like it is, like, you don't have time to make this change today.
Yeah.
We can implement that for you on the next show or the next two shows.
Yeah.
But we cannot do that for you today. If you have somebody that's just like a yes person, is just like, yes, absolutely, we got this done. And then all of a sudden doors are open and you haven't even tested it, and that stuff goes wrong during the show, you are in trouble.
Yeah.
And the artist doesn't understand why, because they don't know what goes into it. So it's a challenge for sure.
It's wild. It's wild. No, I think I've learned over the years, still I always learn, of course, but learning to, from like my music side, to sort of really really iron out what the timeline is for delivery at all stages. So that, okay, show one's here, rehearsals are here, and then pre-production time is here, arrangement time, the ideation time is here, but I would imagine delivery of time code revision 1 is here. and yeah. that means we should start last week, that kind of thing. But I mean, we've all been in those production rehearsals where the programmers, lighting programmers, video guys are working 24 hours a day because
yeah.
changes happen. I'm all about finding ways, whether it's possible or not, to like change that, because it doesn't feel very healthy, those kind of 24-hour days where you're cramming They're like not. A week's worth of work into 48 hours.
And it's also like the work that comes out of it isn't good, right? Like at some point, I mean, I attribute it to songwriting. Like at some point, sorry about that.
Sorry.
So I attribute it to songwriting. At some point, like in a songwriting session, you're tired and you're not producing your best work, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing for anybody that's behind a computer trying to type an email at like 4 o'clock in the morning after working for, you know, 18 plus hours, or the same for anybody who's behind a lighting console that's trying to write a cue with like timing. So I need it to be 3 seconds long, but I need this light to start at 0 and this light to start at 3, and then and like figuring out like there's just a lot of maths involved yeah. with some of the stuff. Or yeah. like when you're making video edits and you know you cut it at the wrong point, and now when you render it out over however long the render time takes, which is a long time, you play it back and it's like, oh shoot, that cut is offbeat, and it's now this throwing this big white flash of light, like not even on a beat, it's like yeah. in the middle of beats, and then it makes the whole stage look like it's off time. Like those are the things that happen when you're tired. And
yeah.
I personally, like, I've been trying to, and it doesn't work all the time, but I've been trying really hard to instate like a set amount of time that you're allowed to program till, and then have to get, you know, 7-8 hours of rest and downtime between sessions. Like I've been trying to implement that as much as possible. It doesn't always happen, but, yeah. You know, it's really important to be able to explain the reality to a production team and to a management team that like, no, these people have been up for a long time. And like the reason why you're seeing some of these mistakes happen is because they're literally exhausted. So
yeah, I tried to implement something on the current project, well, the project was on last year, which was, it's okay to make musical changes if you're in the moment as a show evolves over the course of a campaign, totally.
Yeah.
I tried to instill that, but let's not make that change between soundcheck and show. So any yeah. change that is made, we try and set and sound check. We work out what would need to happen logistically from all departments to be able to deliver that in a show, and we implement that on the next show or however long each department reports back they need to do that, so that everybody isn't stressed out working all the way to doors or into the festival set. For the exactly same reason as you said, people, it just burns them out and mistakes happen that way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, honestly, it's such a machine, right? Like there's like putting together a production of this size, I mean, it's millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars going yep. into this, right? So yep. depending on the size, obviously it's not millions and millions and millions of dollars for a smaller show, but it's definitely a lot of money going out, and it's a way for artists to make money. It's kind of the only way that they make money these days. So you would think that the proper planning would happen on the front end, but we're still a very new industry.
Mm.
Like, honestly, like it, compared to healthcare,
sure,
or compared to like even like home building and architecture, and you know what I mean? Like we are very, 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 very new industry in the scope of industries. So I know that there's still going to be, you know, a lot of figuring out our ways, and we're always going to innovate. But I do feel like the proper planning of a tour is something that always seems to be like left as like the last thing. I don't know. And proper planning includes getting that set list, right? Or
yeah, right. Yeah.
Just like, even just like, we're going to play these songs.
Yeah. Do you feel, have you seen that in throughout the course of your career so far, that those things are changing, like the industry is becoming more professional, more teams yeah. are becoming more aware of the planning and all logistics at the front end that are needed? Because I've been finding that yeah. as well from my perspective, that
yep.
industry is professional now. Yeah, it's earning hundreds of, it's earning billions a year in exported live yeah. music around the world. And the technology is obviously forever evolving, better than ever. We can create any kind of show. We've been judged our, as an MD, my work's been judged by what somebody sees on their phone, the audio quality from their phone, and again, from your the visual content you see on a live stream on YouTube or something. I'm finding that it's actually, I think in a positive way, bringing more professionalism into the workforce, that there's more accountability. There are, I still think there's a massive long way to go in terms of like human resources
and supporting
for like freelance base within the industry, which is a whole other thing. But it kind of leads me a little bit to the Even Network, which I'm desperate to talk to you about, because with Learn Like Music, it's like, how do we, I love our industry and I love every part of, you know, I love the ideas that they're going to create a show. I would speak to a tour manager about routing and logistics spreadsheets for hours if anybody would ever entertain me, but they won't. I mean, I love it. I love our world. So I'm curious about it, but I'm also curious about, okay, with post-pandemic, when crew of people have not come back to the industry necessarily, and the schedule's been stacked for the last couple of years, crew are getting burnt out because they're now doing too many shows. Not enough physical resources, like not enough PA, not enough LED screens. What is the future in terms of like educating the next generation of like live music professionals? And if we could hypothesize, what would that be? What kind of things will we instill? Like, what if we create a space where people can learn about accounting and finance in terms of their personal finance of being a freelancer, but also how to grow a business within the creative world, within live, or how a tour manager schedules a tour, or how a front of house engineer goes about gain stage, and all the million amazing things that lead to pathways in real jobs with real income that you don't necessarily need to go and get a college degree for. We're passionate about that because that's kind of my experience. I went to university here and dropped out of the first year because I was working multiple jobs to learn how to be a drummer. And I felt like, I guess, precocious, naive youth was like, I don't need a degree to be a touring session drummer. But went and got a gig and didn't earn any money for years, and found myself after 20 years now having a career. So I'm like, Learn That Music for me and for us, me and Matt, our team, is how can we create resources where people can learn about these amazing skills, about amazing industry, have pathways for careers with really great salaries if you're very good and you're a good person to work with, all those things, that the caveats that go with it. What if that existed? And I can't see anywhere in the world that it does. And then I came across you, and then I came across the Even Network, which is exactly everything that we would love to do. So tell me about it a little bit.
Yeah, okay. So during the pandemic, I was working with several other designers. I mean, we did this like nonprofit thing where we were basically getting artists to like answer trivia questions and posting these YouTube videos. And it was all about creating awareness that our industry shut down and we're screwed and whatever. We were just basically trying to get grocery money for our roadies. And through that, a couple of us sort of branched off and realized, well, it was like 25% of our workforce is going to be disappearing because of the pandemic. So how are we going to build it back? Like, how, you know, the big we, like, how is the industry going to build it back, right? And why not build it back in a more diverse manner? Because, you know, I mean, I was the only girl on tour bus for years and years and years and years, which is fine. I mean, I had no problems, honestly, like, unless I was really naive. Like, I've only really had maybe three incidents in my 23 years in this business. Right. I felt like I was a woman in the industry and not, you know, a lighting designer or a production designer. So it still happens. Actually, one of those these incidences was very recent. But it's few and far between for me, my personal experience.
Yeah.
But I mean, honestly, like, I think that the problem for us, we realize, is like there's a visibility issue. And it's literally what I said earlier about how, you know, we're supposed to be the magic behind the scenes. It's like secret and no one's supposed to know about us. So I think because of that, we have a pretty big visibility problem on our industry. I mean, for me, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, Vermont. My parents were like, you've got good grades, go be a doctor or a lawyer. I was like, no, I want to go on the road with bands. I've made a pretty good career of it, so I think I'm okay. But they were like, those are friends, do that. That's not like a career. You don't make money doing that. You travel with them and you don't. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think this is the business. And so it's the same thing with my lighting director on Coldplay. Actually, he was supposed to be a professional baseball player, and something happened with his shoulder, I think. I'm going to just tell a story and apologize to him like in five go see him down the road. But he had gone to shows at the Apollo, and he always kind of like watched the stagehands, but Apollo Theater in New York. He didn't really realize that that was a career path until he asked the right questions of the people that were like sweeping the stage between bands. Mm. And so then he became a stagehand at the Apollo, and now he's, you know, through his career path, he's now the lighting director on Coldplay, and he gets chefs every night, right? Yeah. But that's a really good example of how, like, you know, underserved communities just don't see these as career paths because they think they need to be an artist on stage or an athlete or,
yeah,
right?
Sure. Like, it's just, absolutely.
Yeah. And this goes for all sorts of communities. It's, you know, across the planet. So anyway, so we realized that, you know, we need to first engage the community and explain that these career paths exist and that you can go around the planet and make good money and work in music. And your career has longevity because you're not just the trending hit single on Spotify for 10 weeks. You know, yeah. you've got this job that is now taking you around the planet for however long you want to do it. Anyway, so once the idea of these career paths exist, we then put them through an education platform, which is basically gives an overall view of every aspect of the industry, super overall basic. It's called Even Basics. So audio, lighting, video, production management, tour management, special effects, all of it. And there's like a financial module and then a mental health module. And the idea is that, like, you get interested in a certain track. So like, as you're going through and you're like, oh, that audio sounds really cool, like I want to eventually mix monitors for an artist side stage.
Yeah.
Cool. So once they get through the program, we pair them with a mentor that is actually mixing monitors, right?
So cool.
And then that person helps guide them into a paid apprenticeship, which means they have to continually educate themselves to keep furthering their careers, right?
Yeah.
So it's end to end. It's community engagement, education, mentorship, and then paid apprenticeship program. We are now working with the Department of Education and Labor in California and developing an actual registered apprenticeship program with them.
Wow.
What is that Incredible. Program? Yeah, it's crazy. What they're trying to do is was basically what we were trying to do with Basics. So it was like, oh, well, we should just pivot and like work on this for a second, because yeah. Once it works in California for a year, it will be spread through the federal government. So
wild.
Any state could basically have this registered apprenticeship program. And so the idea was that, like, you have to be an apprentice to be a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter. Well, like, plumbing, special effects deals with plumbing. You need piping and, you know, chemicals and gases and everything in order to, like, get, you know, the pyro in order to, it's all like chemical, right? And then electrician, obviously, like, as a lighting tech, you need to have basic knowledge of electrician work.
Yep.
Carpentry, we yep. have stage carps. So it's just the idea of, like, it's really vocation based. It's like, you need, there's not enough focus on the vocation of being in our industry. I feel like everyone's like, oh, I gotta go to a university, but no, it's not true. Like, you don't have to pay for a university to be in our business. Like,
yeah,
you
totally agree.
Just learn the skill sets. Yeah, so that's Even. And we just hired a program manager full time. So hopefully we'll be launching and getting this stuff out the door a lot more quickly.
It's so exciting. So it's a not-for-profit, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we're an official 501c3.
Incredible. Oh, it's...
Yeah.
Honestly, I want that to then happen over here. It sounds incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely are going to expand it over to the UK. I mean, without a doubt, it's just a matter of like how and when, right?
Yeah, sure.
We've already been contacted by so many people over there just because I'm over there so much with music Coldplay. I feel like we've got the connections to be able to do it. Yeah. We just have to do it. Yeah.
I love it. I come from a a small town in the northwest of England, not too far from Manchester, which I'm sure you've been to a bunch of times.
I can tell in your accent.
Yes, yes. it's a bit softer than my wife or my kids because I've travelled a little bit and they haven't, but yes, it's there. But the thing is, I've got a friend here who runs a special effects company, and his big thing is, depending on where you come from, your community, so around here, like core skill sets like being an electrician or a plumber or a builder are all really integral things to the local community in terms of industry. And his big thing is, why would we just teach kids that it could just be a builder and that's all? It's a really great thing to do as a profession, and it means work. But you could be an electrician and come and tour the world setting off effectively explosives and fireworks and confetti in stadiums and make a living out of it. We're just not telling the kids that these things exist. Which is that what I'm getting is the sort of the core of even is that, yes, it's amazing. People just need to know that these things exist and there are career pathways. And it's a really fun industry to work in.
Yeah. And imagine, like, this is what I say too, because I've always wanted to start this other nonprofit in the US where we like take somebody from rural America and give them a passport and like send them someplace overseas, like, and make them work or do something there for like 2 weeks where they're just like engrossed in like culture. A different culture. Because like brain, when you travel, even if it's just outside of your own little home area, your brain of like, it just explodes because you're now realizing, oh, not everybody does stuff that way. Got it. And I just feel like that's one of a pretty big challenge in our world right now is like not understanding other cultures and other ways of doing things. And the best way to learn about that is by travel. And that's one of the coolest things of our business is you get to travel around the world and see all these different cultures and learn how to order beer in many different languages or whatever. Like, it's just, I think that's another like pretty important part to me is like just being able to get people who are, you know, stuck out of their comfort zone and out into the world to learn more.
I love it. I mean, with all these businesses and not-for-profits and startups, I don't know how you're going to find time to do all this.
I'm definitely not going to be able to do that one. That is not going to happen anytime soon.
Imagine if anybody else
has interest in helping me with it, great. But
I imagine if the federal government supported that program as well. That would be so cool.
My God, I know. Honestly, like, I think I just need to find like a travel company to be like, this is what I want to do. Help. I can't even imagine. Anyway.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's an actual joy talking to you. If there's a way to wrap this up, it'd be like, what would be, there's not a single point of advice for anybody wanting to start out in industry, but particularly lighting production, where would people somebody start if they wanted to venture down that pathway?
I mean, the first thing is like ask questions. Like I answer, case in point, I answer all my Instagram messages.
Thank you.
As long as they pop up, like I answer them. Sometimes they, for some reason, they go to like the spam thing and I don't realize that that even exists until later on. But always ask the questions. And I almost always give out my email address. My assistant is just like, can we have other things? Like, yeah, but this is important. Also, you know, go to a vendor. Like it might be hard to find those, but like we do have Google. So Google does help find these places. And like, I have people ask me all the time, like, hey, I've done a little bit of theater backstage work. I would like to learn more about the concert side of things. Where do I go? And I'll connect them with a local vendor, you know, that.
Amazing.
And then you just have to go there. And even if it's like pushing cases or boxes, the next step is like, if you finish work at 3 when you were supposed to go till 5, don't leave at 3. Stay there for 2 hours, find a lighting console, get on that thing and start learning. Or, you know, go and do whatever you can in the shop there. You're learning something different. Like if you have 2 hours suddenly free time, instead of going home and like enjoying that free time at home, like, take it as time to learn. Or ask if the shop isn't closing till 7, but you're done at 5, ask to stick around for 2 hours so that you can learn from whoever is teching lights down at the other end. Or, you know, just the thing is like, our careers are not like, they're not jobs, they're careers and they're lifestyles. Like you end up eating, sleeping, with people on buses for years, right? Like,
yeah.
And so you kind of have to treat it that way. You can't treat it like I'm going to, you know, I'm working at Mackers, as you guys call it over there. And I'm going to call in sick tomorrow because I have a headache. That doesn't work that way. It's like, this is a passionate career that you yeah. have to understand is going to be your life. And so if you want to learn about it, then make it your life. Like, take the time, network, ask questions.
Yeah, that's a whole that's exactly what you need to do yeah. if you want a career in the music industry. Suna, thank you so much. I can't say thank you enough. It's been an absolute joy.
If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure to join the industry, our email newsletter, where each week we send you something to read, something to watch, and something to listen to, as well as the latest news from the live music industry. You can find it in the description or at learnlivemusic.com.